Welcome to The Foundry, where leaders are forged daily. Each week, we investigate themes of leadership, entrepreneurship, and mindset with some of the greatest minds in real estate. And now, the data scientist of real estate, George Roberts.
Welcome back, entrepreneurs. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Diana Lin, an architect, developer, and multifamily sponsor. Diana is a partner and co-founder at Navi Ventures, where she's focused on acquisitions and asset management of existing value-add opportunities and ground-up multifamily developments in the Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico markets. Diana is currently working on a 150-unit ground-up multifamily unit development in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Navi Ventures is a real estate company that seeks to acquire and or develop multifamily assets that will positively impact the lives of their communities and investors. The company has investments in 1,800 multifamily units, 700 as a general partner, for an aggregate acquisition value in excess of $215 million, with currently $93 million under management at this time. Diana is an AIA licensed architect with over 10 years of experience working in New York, Texas, and China, where she has designed and managed large-scale award-winning buildings in office, multifamily, hospitality, and retail. Her design and technical background as an architect uniquely positioned her to envision and identify real estate opportunities beyond numbers that are often overlooked. So with that, welcome to the show, Diana.
Hi, thank you for having me, George.
All right. Well, I'm really excited because you've got a very exciting background and a lot of things that I want to jump into. But first of all, I know that you have, at least at one point, over 1,200 LP units. I think a lot of those were traded in the last couple of years or so. So just starting as an LP, what were your biggest lessons that you learned?
Yeah. So my husband and I, we were working full time. And so I was a full time architect. My husband, he's a full time real estate lawyer, right? So we didn't have time to sponsor any deals. And so passive investing through syndication was a really good option for us. So we opted to invest into syndication deals as passive investors. And it was a good 3 years investing as a passive until we got our first full cycle deal, which is great because typically the deals that we invested, they say 5 year hold, right? But these deals, you know, market was great, you know, a couple of years ago, and they sold in 3 years.
So the time frame is like 2020, 2021.
Yeah, 2021. Yeah. So yeah. We invested our first deal in 2018 and we stopped in 2019. We invested about 8 deals in those 2 year time frame. Then we're like, okay, we're going to wait until this syndication deal goes full cycle to kind of see if this concept actually works, right? So
yeah,
2 times your return. And so we held off a little bit investing in 2020, but then in 2021, 4 of our deals went full cycle and we saw that it worked, right? So, or proof of concept on this. And that's the year when we actually switched over to being a sponsor instead of a passive investor. So back to your original question about what's our biggest learning lesson or like what we took away from that experience is that when we started off, we didn't know much. We just had to make an investment to kind of learn, right? And after a few deals investing passively is when we realized that it really is much, we believe that investing with a good and honest or even an experienced sponsor is more important than the deal itself. I mean, the deal with the numbers and the comps and the market, all that, if it looks good on paper, that's great, but it means nothing if a sponsor can't execute the business model, right? So we shifted our evaluation of looking at investments of first heavily vetting the sponsor, and then we would vet the deal itself, right? So that's kind of our learning lesson as a passive investor, and we still even apply it to even as a sponsor.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as much as you can learn ahead of time, I greatly recommend it. there's nothing like having skin in the game, some real experience to drive those lessons home. So great timing and cool transition too. If you want to talk a little bit about your transition from LP to sponsor, I think that would be very helpful to a lot of people in our audience.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So that transition was something that we were considering for a while, but didn't know whether or not we were ready. And so this one pivotal experience, I believe, is what pushed us to look heavily into being a sponsor. Is when at that time I was pregnant with my second child, and my husband was asking for his boss for 2 weeks of paternity leave, which is really nothing, but it's something in Texas. And so his boss kind of told him, okay, yeah, you can totally take those 2 weeks off, but just know that you're on point on your projects, right? So it's not really paternity leave. So even when my second child was born, he was still working, right, at home, not really present. Yeah. So we knew that we had to make some take a step to find a way to be a little bit more flexible with our time, and that's real estate, right? And so when we saw the proof of concept of some of our passive deals, we're like, okay, this is something that we should really heavily consider. And so we decided that we need to educate ourselves how to be a sponsor, because being a passive investor doesn't mean you know how to operate a deal, right? You can observe other sponsors how to operate it, but when you're behind the wheels, it's a completely different experience. So when we decided that we want to learn to be a sponsor or be a sponsor, we looked into tapping into a mentor or a mentorship program to help us understand and guide us through the process. So our first deal, so after we got a couple of deals that went full cycle that same year, that we decided to, instead of recycling those proceeds into passive deals, we took some of that money and decided to use that money to invest into a education group and a mentor, and then also invest into our first deal. So our first deal was a 22 unit deal in Arizona. And so we've been sponsoring since then.
Yeah, I love it. I love your story. I love how you can smile about it now, about how your husband hardly got any time off. I know I've worked some jobs like that, like bioscience. I remember one of my children born, I asked for a week off, probably the only time I took off at that entire job. And boss said yes right away. And I thought, oh my God, I didn't ask for enough. Mm-hmm. You know, how it goes with negotiations. If they say yes right away, well, you didn't make a good deal. So, yeah.
right.
Whoops, but you live and learn. So yeah, it's just definitely a different world. And I gotta say, you know, I know there's a lot of entrepreneurs in our audience. One of the things we focus on here, it's a completely different world when you can just, you know, get your work done and then do what you really need to do. So right. Congratulations for making it to the other side. But you have a lot of interesting transitions in your experience, because so not only did you go from LP to sponsor, but after becoming a sponsor, I believe that's when you started to invest in single family homes.
Yes. So, you know, single family home was something that it was interesting, because like I was a passive investor. And when we stopped in 2029, because we invested enough into LP deals, I wanted to keep on investing in real estate. So instead of putting all our eggs in one basket of multifamily, I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm going to look into single family rentals. We haven't done single family rentals, right? For long-term, for the 1 year hold, or just cash flow, right? So I decided to look into single family rentals, and that's during our break from passive investing. That's what I did. I got my first deal buying our first single family rental. And then we converted our primary house into a rental. So then we had two rentals. During that time when I was working on our single family rental is when I realized, okay, this is too much work. So it was being a landlord, right? And to always be on call whenever the tenant calls you to say, hey, there's beehive that's bothering me and I'm barbecuing.
Yeah.
And I just like, and I'm in the middle of trying to essentially raise for a multifamily deal, much larger scale. And so it just kind of took up some of my time, because you have to anticipate those calls, right? Oh, toilet's leaking, or there's a leak. So you had to take a good like 2 hours from your full-time focus into these little calls. And so we addressed them, but then I decided that I needed to hire a property manager just to like handle my single family, because I didn't want to handle these type of work orders, right? So that's why we like multifamily, because then we can hire property managers to take care of these day-to-day operations.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love professional property managers, but I also love to talk to people who have managed their own properties because they've got great stories. Anything crazier than a beehive during a barbecue?
I mean, it seems like a, you know, typical kind of calls that you get randomly, that where, in, especially in Texas, the heat is ridiculous. It's hot. So I'm at a real estate conference trying to meet some more multifamily professionals, and I get a call and my tenant says his AC is down. And so it's in the middle of the summer where it's 110 degrees outside. And I just freaked out because I just don't like the idea of having my tenant be melting in his own, like this rental house that I own. So I felt responsible. So it took me a good day. Well, I mean, I found at that time there was a lot of AC repairmans that were busy because it was super hot. Yeah. And a lot of AC,
they all break down at the same time.
At the same time, so it was hard to find someone. So they finally found someone, paid a good premium for it to come out the next day. So it's not that crazy. But then another story is when one of the house that I, the single family rental home, is 1970s, so it's cast iron pipes, right? So the one of the pipes leaked, and so we had to go through some major repairs, and it cost $8,000 just like that. And that's when I said, okay, there goes my cash flow for the past 2 years of this repair. And so it was a ride, but it was an experience too.
Yeah, well, you know, that also raises an interesting question to me, that as an architect, obviously have some experiences that other people don't have. You mentioned, I think, in 1970s cast iron pipe. Every vintage of building has its own issues. So do you, as an architect, does that impact the way you do your physical due diligence?
In terms of like looking at houses, right, looking at rehab houses, I mean, it depends, because I mean, I'm able to look at certain properties with a trained eye, right? So say, for example, like before we got into multifamily syndication, we were attempting to do our own real estate development deals, just small scale, right? We bought a lot that was just an old single family home. We're going to level it and we're going to build a duplex, right? So, and long story short, we ended up selling the land to another developer, and the developer came back to us saying they can't finish. So they were asking us to take it back or take over. So we looked at at least myself, I was looking at this house that he was 80% done. And I saw that the stucco wasn't applied correctly, right? I saw that the height of the stairs were not to code. And so I just didn't want to inherit a project that could potentially be a liability for us, when I knew that there's already red flags during that due diligence period of whether or not we'll take over that project. So new build, yes. For rehabs, I have a lot more experience with new builds, because as an architect, I mostly do new builds. I do some renovations as well, but not as much as new builds. So then when I go into rehabbing a project, I would be able to look at certain things, but not as much as new builds, right? And so I would know that we don't want to take on a single family that has asbestos, right? Or we want to make sure that the concrete is at least leveled, right? And so in a way, I didn't really know a lot of that stuff until I got into the industry, and especially for rehab, because I didn't have as much exposure as new build. So it's different eye, different trained eyes for different type of assets.
So do you also have a building inspector walk around with you for another set of eyes?
I did for my single family rental, because it was my first one. We had a, not building inspector, but more of a contractor, because this contractor has done a bunch of flips and also rehabs and single family. So was relying on their experience to tell me what is necessary for the renovation, because as an architect, I I tend to over design. So then it'll be probably more expensive than necessary for what the market needs, right? So it was helpful to have someone that is experienced and done renovations and understands the market to tell me that, okay, you just need to put granite. Don't even put, onyx or marble, So yes, I had to kind of pull back from my typical type of buildings that I would design for, which is a little bit more higher end.
So not only an architect and a sponsor, but you're also a developer. And as such, you have opportunities open to you, not open to most other sponsors. So my question is, build or buy existing and why?
That's a great question, and I think it's always up for debate of which of the two is better, because when I got into syndication, it was really because ultimately I was interested in development, right? But development itself is risky. It's takes a lot of capital and takes time until your building is ready for cash flow or to sell. So when we did our first development, it was outsized risk for the amount of money that we got to put in a duplex, right? So we didn't actually went through with developing because the risk was too high for us and we didn't have as much equity back then. So the idea was to get into a value add deal or a multifamily deal where we take more of a calculated baby steps into investing, where on day one, when you invest, you cash flow, right? So we thought it was less risky to get into a value add deal. And then so when we slowly invested over a couple of years, then the equity that we've earned from the sale of the property, we grew our net worth and equity further, where we can take bigger risks such as development. We're more comfortable in doing that, right? So that's kind of what our trajectory was, is to kind of build our kind of pad our reserves and savings to be able to take on or handle larger risk like development. So when we had enough or felt that we're comfortable enough, we stepped into development, and each time we get into a different asset class or a different type of a scale of building or renovating, we always make sure that we're partnered with someone that will be able to guide us through the process. And that itself mitigates the risk as well, right? Because we learned a lot from our duplex development, which never happened just because we didn't look for partners or find mentors to guide us through the process. So we learned our lesson and knew that we're going to anytime we go to something different that we're not comfortable with, we're going to have to tap into a partner or a mentor to help us.
Yeah, great way to level up and to fast forward to the present. Now you're taking on projects as large as 150 multifamily units ground up. So why don't you tell us about that project?
Yeah, for sure. So this one is going to be in New Mexico. So I'm in Dallas, and this project's in New Mexico. We have a partner who is local to the area. He lives in Albuquerque. And so when we were interested in developing multifamily, we just, like I've mentioned before, we needed a partner that knew what they were doing. So we found our partner through networking and through masterminds. And so he needed someone to essentially take care of the capital raise as well as asset management, and he was just focused on developing, right? So it was a complementary skill set, and it just happened to be, stars were aligned, and we made that partnership happen. And we're currently in a process of putting the deal together, and it's just been a great learning experience, especially with an experienced developer. He's been developing for about 20 years, right? And then he just started to get into syndication himself. So he's learning from us as well about how to structure a deal through syndication for a development deal, right? Because typically what he does all his deals out of his own pocket. He never raised outside money, right? So in order to scale, he needed to find partners. And so we just found each other, and it just made sense. And so now we're partnering on a deal, and so the deal itself is entitled already. The land is entitled, and we've already just sent over our 65% construction drawings for bid. And so we're working with the architect closely as well as the engineers. And everything is familiar process for me because I've been through that for a bunch of my new builds as an architect. But it's nice. It's interesting because now I'm on the developer side and equity side. And so I'm getting exposed to the process I was never never seen on the developer side, because we're looking at a much bigger picture as opposed as an architect, you're plugged into one process of the development, right? And so that's kind of where we are right now on this deal.
So I have to ask this question because my family is in development. What would you say to someone who says that developers are just selfish and greedy? I mean, besides, F you.
They get a pretty bad rap on the media, I feel, because in the media, they're kind of portrayed as kind of greedy, selfish individuals that's just trying to look for profit, right? And I think you really got to look at both sides to it, right? Because it is a business, but at the same time, I believe that developers really do need to get out there to communicate about why they're doing what they're doing, because in a way, we're providing housing, right? And so if there's not enough housing, who's going to build it, right? And so you need experienced individuals like developers to add more roof to the area. And if not, then, I mean, you could be living in a street, right? And, or the affordability is not even there, right?
I love it. That should be the quote of this entire podcast. If it isn't for us, you could be living in the street.
I mean, no, I'm not saying
that's totally true. Right?
We all work together to be able to provide housing. And so even for our development, we're trying to go for attainable housing because there's not enough housing in the city or in the market, the price, the affordability is non-existent. It just climbs up because the demand is so high, but the inventory is so low, right? And so people will complain about, you know, why is housing so high? Because we don't have enough housing. So the government and also the public and the private sector are working together to address this problem. And so the city provides incentive for developers to be able to have the deal pencil and able to come in and build and be able to fulfill the demand of housing. And when there's more housing, then the prices will start to stabilize, right? So I think when you look into macroeconomics, we're not as evil as you think we are, or at least what your parents think we are. But like, it's the same thing for value add, right? It's not just developer from ground up. It's people who are going into finding these housing that is 50% vacant and renovating it to be occupiable and pleasant place to live. And now it's 100% or 95% occupied, right? Because we're able to provide decent place to live for individuals or residents, right? Both address the need of having to provide housing for others.
Yeah, I love it. And I appreciate the way that you express both sides of the coin. There's the possibility of outsized profits, but there's also huge risk that these developers undertake when they do this. And a lot of people don't understand, like, why are you just out there building, you know, class A units for the rich. And one of the things that I think most people don't realize is that that actually does put downward pressure on rents all across the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And so these developers that are out there building for, you know, whatever you want to say, the rich or whatever the buzzword is now, the 1%, et cetera, that it really does impact housing across the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I touched on before, it's how they communicate when they come in and don't even interact and have the community participate in what they envision this building next door to be, then yes, you're the evil developer because you're not including everyone in this community that you are entering into. Right. So and I've met a lot of developers who genuinely are there to provide housing and not, they make little, I guess not little to no, but like they do make some profit, but that they don't make extravagant profit. But in order to be able to provide housing for their community, right? And so I meet a lot of passionate developers who focus on just their community, and they are ingrained in their community, and the community supports the developer himself. And so that itself is a symbiotic relationship, because the community knows that housing is needed because they see it, right? And so the developer works hand in hand with the community leaders to be able to integrate the feedback of what they're looking for and to provide what they need, right? So that's the best way to be able to provide housing. And you're the evil developer if you don't talk to them at all, right?
Yeah, very well put. I think it is good to get out and speak to the community, be integrated with the community. Although I hate to say it, but my experience has been that no matter how nice you are, the community can still rise up and respond to you through these stereotypes, as opposed to how you might actually be as a person. So I just wish I could reach the people. They're probably not listening to the podcast today. they go up and they're just against every development and say like, well, hey, when you're like that, I mean, that kind of takes a little bit of the incentive that developers have to go out and be nice and seek input if it's all going to end up the same way and you're just going to be against everything we do.
Right. There's going to be a few individuals that will be completely against it. And so you can work with them for so long. But then if there's a larger percentage of the community that do support it, then you listen to them. Right. But if the majority of them are against it, there's a good reason. Right. So you got to listen. And then the city council got to listen to their constituents. Right. So it just has to be all aligned in terms of vision.
Yeah. Sounds like you've had some better experiences than me, so I'm glad for that.
I had some bad experience, but yeah.
I'm sure you have. Well, without a doubt, it goes with the territory. Uh-huh. All right, well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up here, and I just want to say what a great episode. Now, if you think that barbecue beehives was exciting for the first half, just stick around for the second. We're going to talk about physical due diligence, pivoting, and passionate living. We're also going to have an opportunity to talk about some blue lava mountain that Diana had a chance to see. So if you're excited about travel and all the great things that you can do as an entrepreneur, definitely stick around for the second episode. And before we wrap, just want to make sure everybody has an opportunity to reach out to you. So email, website, carrier pigeon, smoke signals. What's the best way for our listeners to reach out to Diana Lynn?
Reach out to me by my email is good, diana@navi-ventures.com, or just follow me on LinkedIn or reach out on LinkedIn.
All right, perfect. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your knowledge and experience with our audience.
Yes, thank you so much, George. Pleasure.
All right.